Hashtag Sisters in Law is going on tour in May. Get tickets at politicon.com/tour. You can see us live at the Athenaeum Center in Chicago on May 2nd, the Royal Oak Music Theater in Detroit on May 9th, and the Schubert Theater in Boston on May 30th. Go to politicon.com/tour to get your tickets now.
Hello, and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week, our guest is author and staff writer at The New Yorker, the great Evan Osnos. Remember, we love taking your questions, so write into politicswarroom@gmail.com or send a tweet to @politicon for next week's show. Now, we're going to get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. And please check out the links to our sponsors, Miracle Made, Z-Biotics, and Henson Shaving in our show notes. We thank you for supporting these sponsors. It really helps make this podcast happen. Please tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Hey, James, we're old enough to remember when Super Tuesday was super, a big deal. This week's 15 primaries across the country changed nothing. Politics today stands just as it did Monday. You know, for almost 20 years, I directed political coverage at two big news organizations. I'm glad I'm not there, because I, too, would have assigned top reporters to write non-stories. The Democratic side, the president won as expected. Turnout, not really impressive. Competition was pathetic. Trump won everywhere but Vermont. As D.C. goes, so goes Vermont. Nikki Haley, not surprisingly, drops out. I predict she'll, at some point, unenthusiastically endorse Trump, as Mitch McConnell did. The Republican Party today is the Trump Party. It's far more than it ever was the Reagan Party or the Eisenhower Party. He and all he stands for are the party. And just some final thoughts on what the Wall Street Journal we used to call minor memos. Trump didn't do very well in suburban areas in Virginia, Colorado, Minnesota. Neither did Trump or Biden in Minnesota. Maybe that causes some concerns for the GOP in November. And the other one was that North Carolina Republicans, outrageous partisan gerrymandering, is going to give them 10 seats. That seems even more clear after the primaries this week, up from 7. That doesn't reflect the state. But the GOP nominated a wacko for governor, Mark Robinson, who advocates a total ban on abortion with no exceptions, calls gay people filth, and peddles rants about Jewish conspiracies. Now, I don't believe much in reverse coattails. I haven't seen them hardly ever. But keep an eye on the Tar Heel State, James.
I will, because Trump said
on steroids,
greater than Martin Luther King. Yeah, on steroids. You know, if you just look at the basics, and here we are in March of election year, the direction of the country, like it's 73 to 76, wrong track. The combined very unfavorable of the two candidates is in the 80s, all right? The third party vote is as big as it's ever been at this point going into an election. The number of people that say they're dissatisfied with the choice is over 2/3 of the people in the country. My point here is not to so much to repeat this gloomy news, but to say that we should expect the unexpected. I don't know how, I honestly, man, I hope and pray and everything that, you know, Trump doesn't win above anything else. But I just think that we're in for a wild ride, and it probably won't come down to just Pennsylvania, Michigan, or Wisconsin, or Georgia, Arizona. So I don't know what it is, but there's some big events coming. And I think a huge event is this trial that starts in New York on March 25th. Either way, it's a huge event.
I slightly disagree with that. I think if Trump gets acquitted, it's a huge event. That'll be a, you know, a
right. The It'll be an unjustified vindication.
If he gets convicted, which he ought to, I think he's going to dismiss. You know, his people will say, so he paid off a porn star mistress. Big deal. I hope I'm wrong, but I kind of suspect that. I don't think the Democrats can count on the courts and the criminal justice system to win this election. I think the Supreme Court did what they did on ballot access. I think the case actually was pretty strong about disqualifying him, but I wasn't surprised by that unanimous decision. I was outraged by the fact that they delayed consideration of January 6th. They showed their Republican colors. That case, the Georgia case, is in political shambles, and the judge down in Mar-a-Lago seems determined to protect Trump. So I guess the point I'm trying to make, James, is that Democrats for too long have said, okay, if he's convicted, I mean, I've thought that too, the courts are going to bail us out. I don't think they are.
This is why I have a different opinion. First of all, it's going to be a jury, all right? And they have to put on evidence. And everybody's going to cover it. And they're going to show, maybe he gets off, but they're going to show, you sign this paper. It's going to, the documentary evidence is going to be overwhelming. And when you say, well, but that's going to be a New York jury. You know what they have in New York? Plumbers, housekeepers, dental hygienists, whatever. So you're going to come there and there's going to be 12. I totally agree. If he's acquitted, they'll go nuts and they'll say, you see, it's all fake. And that will hurt. That will help him a lot. If he's convicted at that point, he's a convicted felon. Your life is not the same. The law, that's not like you're indicted. Okay. Does he have to give his passport up? Does he have travel restrictions?
I
don't know. But all of that is going to, you know, and I think they allow cameras in a courtroom.
They do in civil trials. I don't know if they do in criminal trials or not. Yeah.
Now, I don't know. But even if they're going to be all day going to be coming out with evidence, they're going to be, and they're going to put all kinds of people on, and the bookkeeper and the this and Mars, with the accounting firm. I mean, the evidence in, if he's convicted, it's a big deal. There's never not a big deal if you're convicted of a felony. I can tell you. And his liberty is at issue. And by the way, they could put, suppose that he's convicted, the appeals run out, and he's president.
Well, I was going to say, hope you're right, in the sense that his calculation for January 6th and that friendly judge down in Florida of stretching this thing out is because once he's president, even if he's been convicted, he can pardon himself. In fact, he can't pardon himself in a state and local case.
Yeah. No, that's why don't underestimate the power of a felony conviction in a state court. And believe you me, they're going to make the argument. Oh, it's a bookkeeping thing. You get in front of that jury, and that judge he's a tough guy. All right. And I just think that don't underestimate the power of an acquittal or even of a hung jury. But I think the effects of a potential conviction are way, way under understood. And like I say, he could be facing jail. He might be put in jail when he's, assume he wins, which, I don't know what you do then. They'll have to ask some of our Pam Carl or Seth or Fred or somebody. But that's an issue. But your ass is convicted. Again, they can limit his liberty. They can limit his travel. He might have to get permission from the court to do whatever. There's just fucking power over you, man, when you're convicted.
Well, you're getting me there a little bit. I'm not quite there, but I'm sure hoping that you're right and then I'm off base here.
But I'm pretty sure I'm right about you.
I would agree with that. Hey, James, there is no better journalist in America than our guest, Evan Osnos, who has written a compelling 14,000-word New Yorker piece on Joe Biden, which includes interviews with the president of people around him and analysis from skeptics. Evan, it really is a terrific piece. A lot of talk about, as there should be. My takeaway, Evan, from this was that you that Joe Biden, there's no way he's going to drop out of the race. He dismisses all those polls that show him not winning. He's supremely confident he's going to win, whether he should be or not, and that he's the only one that can beat Donald Trump. Is that a fair summation?
I think it is. Yeah, it's. I have to say, you do a much better job of stating
hardly.
It clearly and concisely than clearly I could. It took me a lot of words to do it. I think you're right. The takeaway, I walked out of that room, even after spending a lot of time around the people around him and so on, but it was really after spending time with him, the dominant impression is that this guy has no doubts. And look, we can have a robust and we should have a big conversation about that, about the validity of his position. But there are different ways the presidents deal with pressure of this kind, doubts of this kind, obstacles. You know, some of them are muttering at the portraits. Some of them are telling their spouse that they're doomed. He doesn't seem to be doing that. Now, look, some of that is he's talking to a reporter. I'm not naive about that. But, you know, I've been doing this long enough to pick up on some of the cues. And this is and I think you guys know this. Everything you know about Joe Biden's biography reinforces his belief that he believes he is being fundamentally underestimated. And that is driving and fortifying him to do what he's doing.
Trump has called the president cognitively impaired. A number of House Republicans claim he's not mentally fit for the job. I should point out that that includes the widely discredited former White House physician, Ronnie Jackson. But they did. And many voters expressed similar concerns. Now, you have a firsthand view. You also are detached. You're a great journalist. Did you sense any cognitive deficiencies?
No. And I'm being very specific about it. I did not. I mean, look, I went in there and I saw him. He's moving more slowly, no question about it. Just the gestures, we all see that. He is, frankly, he just says less than he used to. This is a big thing. If you know, I've interviewed him over the years. He used to fill every silence. He used to sort of filibuster. He doesn't do that now. There's a kind of, he says what he wants to say. And, he didn't mangle a date. He didn't mangle a name. What he did is he sounds very, his voice is very thin. It's kind of clotted, and he clears his throat a lot. But I'll be perfectly blunt. If as a journalist, if I'd gone in there and I sensed that this man was not up to the job, can you imagine what a big story that would have been? What a great story I would have had on my hands. So in a way, you kind of when you're in that moment, you have to look and try to separate out what is he saying from how he looks. And what I heard him saying left no doubt in my mind that mentally this guy is the same as he was when I interviewed him.
The age issue, though, as you write, he's 81. That still dominates. And you alluded in the piece to JFK's celebrated moment, taking on the Catholic issue before those Houston Protestant ministers. It seems to me Joe Biden has a harder task, but any sense of how and whether he's going to address the age issue?
Well, I brought up the JFK speech because it did feel like one of those moments that historically where you took an issue that was dominant in a race and diffused it by tackling it immediately head on. I mean, it's sort of, you know, you could also use Obama's
or Reagan
speech
about in the debate
race
about age
in
Monday.
2008 after the Jeremiah Wright. And in some ways, I think that Biden is choosing to go the He's trying to go the Reagan route instead, which is to make jokes about it, to try to work it on the margins. I came back to the White House. I said, look, if he's going to give a full-throated position, if he's going to give a speech on the subject of age, I want to interview him about that now. And they said, well, look, they made it clear they're not going to be doing that. What they're going to do, and you then saw this on Seth Meyers the other day, is they're going to start trying to land some blows on Trump, which is a pretty large attack surface. I mean, the guy says all kinds of cockamamie stuff. He sounds like he can't get his way through complicated matters of state or of foreign affairs. He mixes up all kinds of people. So it's not like that's a hard thing to make jokes about. Joe Biden is starting to make more jokes about himself. You know, he said at one point that he's never been more optimistic about America in all the 800 years he's served. So there are ways in which you can make light of this where you're meeting people where they are. You're not ignoring it, because if you ignore it, it just festers. But I don't think he's going to go the JFK route on that.
And I'm sure a major vehicle will be the Gridiron Dinner in about 10 days, which is a place where, you know, that was the place where politicians are great at making fun of themselves. JFK once pulled out a telegram from his father that said, dear Jack, don't buy one more vote than necessary. I'm not going to pay for a landslide.
That was the West Virginia primary, I think, right? That was great.
So it it gives him an opportunity. One more thing before I turn it over to James. Mike Donilon and you, others in the campaign, are saying saving democracy is going to be the central issue in the fall. Evan, I believe it should be, but I very much doubt that it will be. Even January 6th, which everyone saw, and that committee, which did a superb job, that didn't really move the needle at all. I mean, I think they're, as you said, they're great issues that Biden has. I'm just not sure saving democracy is the theme that wins it.
This is probably, in some ways, you know, the piece of the story that is the most that has the most stakes to it, because, as you say, Al, it is really a question of what is it that is going to move the needle with people. Messaging, as you and James both know much better than I do, is it's not an either or proposition. It's what's in the foreground, what's in the background. Mike Donilon made a sustained case to me about why he thinks democracy is in the foreground. It, you know, for him, as I describe in this piece, he is in some ways thinking about the 2004 presidential campaign, in which, it, in his mind, Democrats made a mistake by not thinking of it as an election that was still primarily dominated in people's minds by 9/11, not by the war in Iraq, not by the economy, not by George W. Bush's by hostility to Bush. That in the end, people were going to be thinking about the trauma of 9/11. And as Mike said to me, I think people are going to be thinking overwhelmingly about January 6th and democracy. And that is a tremendously controversial issue among people who have run Democratic campaigns, because other people will say, and I look, I will tell you, I'll be the first to say, I can't tell you which one prevails and in terms of which issue is in people's minds. I think in 2022, my job is to try to explain why people are doing what they're doing in this campaign. And in 2022, the polls were telling them, talk about prices, talk about gas, talk about groceries. They talked a lot about other issues, and they take that lesson very deeply, even though they know a lot of people disagree.
So, Evan, in your piece—
All right, James Carville.
They told you they don't believe in polls. Do you believe that they don't believe in polls?
Well, here's what, I mean, what they actually, as you know, of course, they're polling constantly themselves.
Right.
What they're sort of saying is, we don't believe the polls that are out there. We believe our way of doing it. Part of what's going on is, you know, it's very hard to know what the electorate is. When you weight it and how you weight it makes a difference. So one of the things you hear these days, for instance, the New York Times poll, which showed, I mean, surprisingly, the New York Times poll from the other day shows that women are voting, that shows that Donald Trump is winning women. So whether you believe that or not, most people think that's probably not going to happen. But that's just an example of how weighting the poll makes a big difference. I think what they're really trying to say, and you know this better than I do, James, is, you know, a candidate that's not succeeding in the polls is going to find reasons to kick sand on the polls. I think that they also believe that issue polling in particular is hard these days. Because if you ask somebody, how much do you care about grocery prices versus abortion, depends what's on their mind at the moment, what feels most salient to them. So I think that's how they're playing.
All right. So I've known Mike Donilon. Well,
right.
Mike Donilon started his career as a pollster.
Yep.
Okay. I've known him very well since 1986 in Pennsylvania. But so do they say, well, we got polls that show different, because we don't just have the New York Times Center poll. We got 20 polls that all say the same thing. Do they claim to you that we got a secret method that shows us in much better, there's some formula that we have that no one has figured out yet?
No, they don't say that. What they say is that they think that they are discounting some of their own polls the way that they're discounting public polls, meaning that they look out and they say, we don't think that people are all that trustworthy when they pick up the phone and somebody's asking them for their opinion or they're doing it online. I think they also think that that when you get into the voting booth, and this is probably the most decisive fact, this is the fact that is at the beating heart of the campaign's view of the world right now is they believe that as of the beginning of this year, only about 25% of voters in swing states really understood, really accepted that it was going to be Joe Biden versus Donald Trump. And as long as that's the case, then what they say in polls is a very different expression of emotion than it is saying, how do you actually choose when you're deciding between these two?
So I am dying to be convinced. Okay, I want to be convinced so bad, but if you look at the polls of 2016, the polls were actually pretty accurate. If anything, they probably slightly underestimated Trump. In 2020, they overestimated Biden. Going into it, actually was a little bit closer than we thought. 2022 was almost on the money.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I just don't get how all of a sudden in 2024 the polls are no good.
So the
record just doesn't, the data does not support that. We never get surprised.
I'm not here to defend polls. What I'll do is tell you exactly how they think about it. Which
I know,
is
yeah,
problem.
I'm not asking you.
I know.
If I was you or Mike Dollar, I said, Mike, what the fuck is going on here? Tell me what I'm missing, because I see an incumbent with a strong disapproval of 48.
What I think they would tell you, if Mike was sitting here, is, yeah, in 2016, absolutely true. Overall, polls were generally much more accurate than the popular narrative remembers. Where they got it wrong, of course, were in those critical Midwestern states where they just undercounted how much there was, how many working class, non-college educated whites, and so on. So these and those kinds of minor gradations make a huge difference. In 2020, as you say, overstated Biden. Look, at the moment, they don't have, or at least they didn't give me a defense of, you know, of their own polls versus what's out there. I think that they basically believe that right now the polling is junk. They just think people aren't looking at Biden as a candidate for president. They're looking at Biden as a referendum on all the referred pain in their lives, the leftover dissatisfaction about politics and about the pandemic and everything. That's how they view it, James. And I would be surprised if they persuaded you otherwise. But that's their view.
I'm obviously not asking you what you think. I'm asking you what they think, because there's nobody in the country that wants to be convinced more than me. But I was telling yesterday, it's like walking in on your grandmother naked. You can't get the image out of your mind. I mean, you try to forget about it. And, you know, you see, Jesus, 18 strong approval and a 48 strong disapproval. And, do you think, and I'm just asking you for judgment and perfectly well to defer, do you think that they really believe what they're saying, or they got to say something? I mean, one thing in politics I know, even in the most darkest times, you got to have an answer. So do you think they don't believe the polls? What's truer? They truly don't believe the polls, or they truly are not going to say what they think because the polls are so bad?
I think it's a bit of both. I think that, look, this is their project. Their project is to help Joe Biden be reelected because Joe Biden is convinced that he's doing the right thing. And this is a man who, after all, in 1972, when he was running against a guy who had won 7 straight elections, a colossus in Delaware politics, Joe Biden, after all, booked his victory party at the biggest ballroom in Delaware when he was polling at 3%. There's a kind of wildness to his ambition that has always been there. And it has worked out sometimes, and it hasn't worked out. And I think that's a piece of the puzzle. And I that's why that any fair reading of this is that all you can try to do right now is understand why he has dug in and essentially ignored what people have been telling him about precisely the issues you're concerned about. That's what I'm trying to do, is get in his head.
And let's forget about what the people around him believe or don't believe. You seem to be pretty convinced that Biden really believes that he's going to win.
Yeah,
I mean, journalists, and look at this guy, and this guy. Does he tell you how? So how is this thing going to unfold? Here we go.
Yeah. Here it is. In his mind, and, you know, this people can debate whether he's right or wrong.
Right. I'm asking just his mind.
In his mind, he has a kind of conviction that the American public is as insulted by Trump on a spiritual, patriotic level the same way that he is, meaning that they look at Trump and on some level they find, not everybody and not certainly 70 million of them, but that they look at him and they do find him colliding with a basic American optimism. You know, Biden is a kind of, you know, he's been this optimistic voice. That's his public presentation. And it is a big part of how he has gone about his own political career. And I think he looks out, and what this comes down to is how he imagines Americans will respond to the threat that Trump represents. And Biden is shaped inevitably by the fact that in 2020, it did work out. Where I think it's important to recognize is Biden's self-mythology blinds him in many ways to things that are a reality around us, which is that people aren't feeling all that optimistic. People aren't feeling grateful for achievements that he may believe have earned him the right to run election. You know, he sees that as eventually becoming, he thinks that eventually becomes the dominant fact on the horizon. And as I say in this piece, it will go down in history as a catastrophic miscalculation if he is wrong about that. Will be the story.
Alan and I are close to him in age, and I've always believed, you know, in a place called America, and American people were good and decent and fundamentally wise people who would make. I just got to tell you, man, I'm just hard for me to get there. Yeah. And, you know, it's amazing that the guy Trump stands up, there's just one freaking lie after another. Like, you know, there's nobody drilling for oil anymore. The whole everything is collapsing. And people believe him.
Yeah.
And they get, you have 30,000 fact checks, 30,000 documented times. And Pete Dell's 30,001. And I hope President Biden is right. I hope his view of America turns out to be correct. But I got to say, the evidence I see right now is, I just have a hard time being encouraged by it. Albert?
Evan.
Yeah, okay, I say one other thing on that, briefly on this album.
Sure.
You know, I quoted James, as you know, I quote you in the piece telling them that they needed to wake up last fall. And then when I was talking to David Axelrod about this, I thought he summed it up pretty well. What he said in the piece was, I don't know that many people who are talking about democracy around the dinner table and are also concerned about the price of their groceries. So on some level, that is the crisis.
Before I turn it out, so this election is about democracy. So we're voting on democracy, but voting is democracy. If you go in a group or you talk to people, a focus group or something, that's not a conversation. I mean, I think it's a danger to the Republic. I think it's a danger. I think it'll be the end of the Constitution. You have to convince me. I think the whole goddamn Constitution is on the ballot. All right.
Mm.
But I don't think voters share. I mean, I think like I think, but I'm not thinking like they think. I don't think.
I think the one thing that, you know, might give you some hope, and I don't think the polls are wrong now, but I think there is evidence, and pollsters have told me this, that many voters, not the hardcore MAGA voters, have not focused on Trump yet. They've kind of forgotten what happened before. And I think that's the job of this campaign, is to remind them. It's going to be one of the ugly, it may be the ugliest campaign we've ever had. Biden indeed may have appealing issues, Evan, abortion, and even minimize some of his losses on immigration. But do they know, and are they prepared for a really, really slash and burn campaign?
I think so. I remember in 2020, when long before January 6th, when I was interviewing Biden, and he said at the time, he introduced the idea. He said, this thing is going to get very, very ugly, much uglier than it is now. And I imagined January 6th. I mean, it's not. And I think this time when I asked him about it, he said, immediately he shot back. He said, this thing's going to get very, very ugly. And I think he anticipates, without saying it explicitly, he anticipates there will be violence. I mean, I think he says he thinks, as he said to me, he thinks Trump will do anything he can to avoid losing. He does not believe he will concede. He does not believe he will accept the loss. And it doesn't take much creativity to extrapolate what that means. And, one of the hardest things I think about this campaign, exactly as you guys said, is trying to conjure up again the full sensory experience of being in that moment with Donald Trump sending his people to the Capitol, and what that made us all feel like as citizens, and how we felt about the future of this country. And part of the task for Biden and his people is to regenerate that sensation of complete emergency, of that this is all on the line right now. And I know you're unhappy about this and that, and you're unhappy about how much you're spending at the grocery store, and we don't minimize it. But this is what is actually on the line. And that is a task. That is a challenge. And I don't quite know how you do it.
Evan, the palace guard there told you that they reach out. They said they had just called sometimes critic Larry Summers. But I hear from other Democrats that it's a pretty insulated group, that they really don't reach out much. What you talk to outsiders as well as the White House. What's your impression?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of frustration, particularly on the Hill, that they don't get enough input over there. They don't feel like they're having enough influence. I think, I quoted the fact that after David Axelrod came out with his criticisms that, as people discovered, he was described in unflattering terms by the president, according to reports. And I think that sends a message. That's not by accident. You know, anybody else who wants to offer criticism can run into trouble. Now, I do think there is a way in which this is also a reflection of the fact that he has a group of people around him who are not constantly knifing each other in the back. And he has had this long running group of advisors. And that has been a source of stability after 4 years of lunacy in the White House. And the upside and the downside of that kind of stability is it's very hard to get an outside opinion in, but you're not having this constant churn of people going in and out of the administration.
Yeah, that's for sure. Evan, just a couple of short ones and then James can wrap it up. Do you think he'll debate in the fall?
I honestly don't know. I had assumed that he would, but now I'm less sure about it. I think that the chances of him doing it are less than I assumed. I think there's probably, if I was guessing today, I think he might not.
One more, the State of the Union is Thursday night. It's a big opportunity for him. Do you have any sense of what the theme will be, and will he telegraph a second term agenda if he should get one?
I think there's going to be a lot of talk about economics. This is part of their rationale is to say that the MAGA Republican agenda is essentially to give everything to the rich and to leave everybody else by the roadside. And that's a way of telling a story of some of the things they've done. But it's also, that's part of Joe Biden's kind of natural comfort zone. So I think you're going to hear a heavy emphasis on that. It's a way of, they're going to smuggle in some things about age by talking about experience, by saying we've been able to do these things because we know how to to work these issues. But that, you know, I honestly, what everybody's going to be looking for, and we know this, is how does he look? How does he sound? How does he respond? If there's a big, you know, if there's a big moment in the room, as there was last time with Marjorie Taylor Greene and so on, how does he handle that? Does he look vigorous? Does he look quick? That's in some ways the much more, I think, decisive question that is going to be on people's minds.
I agree. James, wrap up this fascinating conversation.
So one thing about old retired washed up political operatives is they can't stop giving advice. And if I were the president, I would say, first of all, I would not use the word inflation. I would talk about cost of living. And we understand what people are faced with. That's why we passed the bill capping insulin costs, because so many families around America. That's why we released the Strategic Program Reserve, because we knew people would deal with the cost of living. The real culprit is what the public thinks, and the public is right, is that there's a lot of price fixing going on out there.
Mm-hmm.
That a lot of companies use the inflation spike to raise prices unjustifiably high. And we know that, and I'm instructing the antitrust division, I don't know, legally, whatever it is, to investigate companies that are raising prices or colluding to raise prices needlessly. Because if you listen to people, the one thing that always comes back, Evan, is they don't really blame Biden for inflation too much because they think he's too old to cause it. Okay, they think the companies are raising prices, and he doesn't understand that.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think again, don't use the I word, the call word, the COL, and talk about that you recognize this early on. Now, how many people are on insulin in this country? Are families of tied to insulin costs? You know, people tend to forget that. Everybody, you know, is at the gas pump. Another thing, this is more true in my part of the world, but this is I won't make one prediction. Watch Florida.
Hmm.
Way, way too easy to dismiss. And the abortion issue is huge. And of course, he's got to ring that freaking bell again and again and again. But these insurance companies are raising their rates like unbelievable. And that is a fixed cost. If you have a mortgage, home insurance is not an option. They'll take your house away from you if you don't have it. So if you paid $2,000 2 years ago, you're paying $4,000 now, that's clobbering you.
Mm-hmm.
And that issue, there's a lot of, you ask people, and I don't know a single person that think these insurance companies are rigging their prices because people are not stupid. But at any rate, I hope he talks a lot about, you know, corporate greed, and all these courts care about is controlling your body and letting these corporations run wild. But
I think you're right on the money. I will tell you internally, one of the messages they think lands the best when they go out and talk to people about it is the idea of corporations and rich individuals gaming the tax code at the expense of the little guy. Yeah. You know, they have this 15% corporate minimum tax they put in, you know, that kind of thing they think is a natural home for Biden. I think you're going to hear more about it, but you're onto it.
Well, on that there, James, we have to let our terrific guest go because he's got other engagements. But everybody out there, you ought to read Evan Osnos's New Yorker piece. You might even listen to the podcast he did with David Remnick. Right. That's the second best podcast that Evan has done this week.
Thank great you, pleasure. Man. Always a treat to be with you guys.
Yes,
thank
sir.
You.
Evan, best to your family, and thank you so much. All right, now for the outrage of this week, of which there are many. when the Koch network came out against Trump months ago, some speculated, well, maybe these fat cats were altering their selfish, mean-spirited posture. Wrong. Once it became apparent Trump would be the nominee, they changed their colors. The Koch network has taken out an eight-digit, you know, that's lots of money, series of ads against the, quote, bad, end quote, Biden economy. I guess they don't like the 3.7% unemployment rate or the 14 million jobs gained in the Biden years. Maybe ask him about the Trump terms when the term when there was a loss, net loss of 2.9 million jobs. This guiltless rich crowd blamed inflation on the Biden spending. Why then is the cost of living, which by the way is coming down a lot, lower than it is in Great Britain, Germany, or most other advanced economies? Was it Biden's spending that caused inflation across the pond? No, of course not. What Charles Koch and his crowd want is to keep a tax code that allows many of them to pay lower rates than their workers and ensure the government can't hold them accountable. They haven't changed a bit.
Well, equally important, as you've pointed out before, these tax cuts are going to be up for renewal in 2025. So, do you know how much money that they saved, a savings rate of this tax cut, what it would cost them? I mean, that's one of the things, if I was meant to say to the union, I would put that issue front and center right now. I mean, taxing really wealthy people polls higher than anything else. It outpolls the Bible. But so for my outrage, when I was a young boy growing up in Louisiana, I got really frustrated. My dad said, "Son, what's the matter?" I said, "Somebody said something stupid." And he said, "Boy, living in Louisiana, being mad at stupidity is like being mad at grass." And it was, that's why I'm 79 and I don't get heartburn or indigestion that much, because I for the most part, I'm amused by stupidity. And of course, you can imagine how stupid the Louisiana legislature is. But they did something that even was so magnificently stupid, I have to count on it. They passed a law, and the new governor signed a law that allows for concealed, permitless carry of weapons in the goddamn French Quarter. So you tell me, let me get to it. And the police were making a lot of stops of people that had bulges in their pocket. Did these idiots really think it's a good idea to have concealed carry, no permit? It used to be you could carry concealed, but you had to go get a permit. You had to be sure that you weren't a felon, and you had to carry the permit with you. Now anybody can carry, and you can hide it. And you can hide it at 3 o'clock in the morning. And there's a part of me that thinks that their strategy is, if they shoot a bunch of people in the French Quarter, it'll make them look better because they can talk about, quote, crime in New Orleans, unquote, which we all know what crime in New Orleans means right off the shoot, don't we? But I cannot tell you, I don't need to tell you how goddamn stupid this is.
All right, James, now for our terrific questions that we get from our incredibly smart listeners. We're going to start with Keith in Taylorsville, Illinois, who asks you, has enough been made of Trump's conviction for sexual assault?
No. The way that I would say it is, he is adjudicated by a jury of his peers to have raped a woman. And that is what Judge Kaplan said. In the common parlance of the word, the jury found that he raped E. Jean Carroll. If you wanted to be technically more correct, you would say sexual assault. But that judge has been on a bench for 40 years, and that's what he said. And I think he ought to be identified as such in every news article, or in, you know, Donald J. Trump, former president, an adjudicated rapist and business cheat. Remember, he was found by a court to have been a business cheat. It's a judgment, like $400-something million. And you can assume that everybody knows it, but people tend to forget it. And, you know, going back to our discussion about the Manhattan DA case, at some point, an accretion of stuff, one hopes it takes hold. 30,000 lives is not taking hold. The most disappointing thing I've ever seen is that the more people today think that January 6th was a tourist visit than did 2 years ago. I gotta say, I gotta get my faith up in people, because it's really hard to when you think about all the shit that happened in this guy's head.
No, you're absolutely right. And I've had, you know, a couple people said, you, and I'm talking about the E. Jean Carroll, you really think Trump would have done something like that? Of course. He told us. Look at Access Hollywood. He bragged about it. I mean, you know.
Did somebody actually tell you, do you really think he would do something like that?
Is that, of course he would.
That person needs to be interdicted. It shouldn't be around other people. I'll give him it's a male of a vasectomy. They don't need him in a gene pool if they're that dumb.
James, Jim in Stockton, New Jersey, asks, would you rather have a Democrat as president and a Republican-controlled Congress, or a Republican as president and a Democratic-controlled Congress? Jim, there are two bad options, but it's an easy call. I'd rather have a Democratic as president and a Republican-controlled Congress, not because I think that's a good scenario. I don't. But I think Donald Trump as president is an existential threat to this country as we have known it, to our democratic system.
My own view is he's a treasonous felon. He doubts his treason, and he's going to be a felon also. So yes, I completely agree with you, because he probably has already sold the nation secrets and showing his invasion plans to people. Yes, I agree with you totally.
Florence in Vancouver, Canada. Boy, that is a fabulous
place.
That
is a beautiful fucking place.
I love Vancouver, yes, Canada. I really do. Florence asked, aren't Supreme Court justices subject to impeachment and removal if they accept bribes? Isn't this still a crime? And isn't it easily provable, particularly with Justice Clarence Thomas?
There's no code of ethics for them. A third grader can get suspended for chewing gum. It's not just Thomas, okay? Look at Gorsuch, okay? Look at Alito. This is my favorite. When he went on that high-end fishing trip on a G5 to Alaska, his answer was, well, it was an extra seat on the plane. Like, I was just hanging out at Dulles Airport one day, and I saw this G5, and a guy comes up and says, hey, we're going to Alaska. We got 14 seats, and we got one available. Why don't you hitchhike it? That's the level of contempt that they have for you. I think underreported is Roberts' wife. That's not a conflict that your wife is a headhunter for a big law firm that practices before the Supreme Court. I don't know what is. And then you had the Gorsuch house sale. They don't, you got to understand something, people. They don't give a fuck. You think that they care? Shit, no. And the sooner that we realize that, the better off we can. Blatant conflict, spousal conflict of interest, conflict with people with business before the court, free trips, SUVs, houses. Oh God, man, it's so bad. The more you think about it, the worse it is.
I'd also invite you to read Jane Mayer's New Yorker piece last week on Clarence Thomas's new clerk that he hired, a woman with, to put it mildly, a terrible bigoted past, and the way they're trying to cover up what happened, Thomas and other judges. Gordon in Norwood, Michigan, says, what could we, in particular Vice President Gore, have done in response to the Bush v. Gore decision? You know, what would the late, great Walter Dellinger have done in response? I actually talked to Walter about this a lot. The mistake, the big mistake that Gore made was in the very beginning, and he picked Warren Christopher as his lead attorney in this Florida case. He should have picked George Mitchell. George Mitchell is as smart as Jim Baker. He's probably even better versed in the law because he was a federal judge, and he's been an elected politician. Not sure it would have changed the outcome, but Al Gore was badly out-lawyered and out-pointed, including by some thugs down in Florida. Would that have changed the outcome? I don't know, but that was a mistake picking Warren
Christopher. Well, let's say what happened. The Florida Supreme Court was going to order a recount. Gore was going to win. So we remind ourselves, the Supreme Court said, we're not even going to give you, we're going to write something on paper, but pay no attention to it because it makes no sense. It doesn't mean anything. Just, we're going to just install him and we're going to stop a recount. And Gore himself, well, we take it and everybody, well, you know, they should have been outraged. There should have been 3 million people descending on Washington. And the event was so much bigger than we even realized. It just wasn't they stole the election. It told them they could get away with anything they wanted to. And that started all of this. And the reaction to Bush v. Gore was way too timid, was way too, well, what you gonna do? It's the court. We decide things in courts. We don't decide them on the street. And that started Citizens United, that started Dobbs, that started Shelby County, that started every ethical, that don't give a shit about ethics or anything else, and the country was too acquiescent in having an election stolen from them.
Yeah, I agree. Rick in South Carolina. Rick, next time tell us where you're from in South Carolina. Rick says to you, James, when I argue that democracy is in danger and Trump will create chaos, people come back and say, you mean chaos like 13 dead Americans in Afghanistan, 2 new wars, 40-year inflation, or a crisis on the southern border? What should I respond? How should I respond?
You mean a 3.5% unemployment rate? You mean a complete turnaround in you know, chip manufacturing and green energy? You mean more people that have health insurance at any time in American history? You mean an inflation rate that is substantially below in all countries, in all prosperous countries around the world? I guess, you know, if you mean all of that, well, I guess so. But you know, if you put each one of these things, are you talking about, you know, from something to this, more oil drilling than any time in American history? I mean, you know, I think that people acquiesce in one version of the story, and there is a counter version to that story that is pretty free. And you're talking about a guy, you know, who took the nation's secrets, and for, you know, there's some that is indicted for 91 different things, is an adjudicated sexual assaulter, is an adjudicated business cheat. So let's think about it. We got some answers here for you.
Yeah, that's really not a hard one to answer if you think about it, really, Rick. Alana in Santa Barbara, California, another great place, says, what would dark, Why, she asked, would dark money be in Trump's camp? Doesn't destabilization hurt the rich and hurt capitalism? You know, Alana, it is one of the things, a lot of these rich people don't know history. They don't understand. They've actually done better under Democrats than they did under Republicans. Electing a president who doesn't believe in the rule of law ultimately threatens them. And even smarter ones like Jamie Dimon says, hey, I can do better. I can do well no matter which one's elected. Jamie, if you got an administration that doesn't believe in the rule of law, that they can come after you someday too.
There's a book, an article called It's Not Even Close. Okay, Alan Blinder is also written on it. If you look at the performance of the country in any any measure that you want, it's not close. And the people have like figured out the probability that it's random, and it's the possibility is so remote you cannot believe it. And I'm talking about unemployment, GDP growth, the stock market, just across the board. And you know, it's pretty bad now, but also on the deficit. I'm sorry, it's just the facts are just there, and they're not even close. And everybody should acquaint themselves with it. This is, and all that, of course, all the Koch brothers care about is to get that tax break. Shit, if you save $20 billion in taxes, you know, so your growth rate is 2% less. Shit, you don't care.
Yeah. No, I agree. You know, I really do. James, our final question is from Jeff in St. Pete Beach, Florida. He wants to know, what was your take on the dueling visits by Biden and Trump to the border? And can we, I guess he means Democrats, gain an advantage on this issue?
I don't know. I don't think you're going to gain an advantage on it, you know, but I do think you have a better answer than before, that they kill us. You know, people go down there. I was in El Paso not very long ago, and what was really interesting is the person that they like to come more than anyone is Mayorkas. They say that he actually listens to them. He cares about it. And when Senator Lankford and Senator Murphy negotiated the deal, they insisted that Mayorkas is in the room because he just knows more than anybody else. Now, are you going to, you know, do people know who Mayorkas is? Or are you going to change any minds? Probably not. But that guy is really smart, is really talented, really understands these issues. And I think they ought to put him out there more.
Yeah.
The conversation gets too one-sided.
No, you're absolutely right. I agree with you. I don't think the Democrats can win on that issue, but I think they can at least somewhat neutralize it because they had a serious proposal supported by the Border Patrol guards down there that gave the Republicans most of what they've been talking about. And Trump and his typical pettiness told the Republicans in Congress, kill it, deep six it. And of course, being, you know, absolute loyalist and obedient, they said, okay, fine. You know, Mr. Whatever you say, boss, we'll kill it. I think that gives Democrats a talking point. And finally, I would say, James, if you look at how Tom Suozzi handled it, the 3rd District in New York, he took it on head on. Don't run away from it. You can't run away from it, and you can take it on head on. And at least
sure
neutralize it.
And don't listen to stupid leftists.
Yeah.
Which he didn't.
Yeah, but they're a minor part of the party. You're right.
They get too much attention. Right. They get too much attention. The White House pays too much attention.
Yeah. No, they do. All right. Listen, we love those questions. We struggle over which ones we can include. If we didn't include yours this week, please write and we'll try to get to it next week. Thank you very much for sending them in. Thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. Don't forget to send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Now, following this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you check out the links to our sponsors, Miracle Made, ZBiotics, and Henson Shaving in our show notes. We thank you for supporting them, because when you do, you help make this podcast happen. Now, to keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. You also can find shows you might enjoy on the Politicon YouTube channel or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast sites. Now remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.